Look into my eyes. We've saved what is probably the most intuitive indicator of trust for the end of the chapter. Surely, you've heard many times before that eye contact is important. Eyes are the window to the soul. You can tell someone's goodness just by looking them in the eye. He wouldn't look at me in the eye and lie, and so on. If you look up advice on dating, job interviews, sales, or just making friends, sustained eye contact will no doubt make the list as a key to what you want. We believe eyes convey emotion and empathy, and that we can literally feel it from others when we lock eyes. As a society, we place a lot of value on the implications of eye contact and what it means for trust in particular. If you meet someone who refuses to meet your eye contact, or conversely meets it for too long, you feel discomfort and leave with a negative impression of that person. People who don't make eye contact are perceived as being untrustworthy or deceitful. This ages-old assumption has been disproven repeatedly, most recently in 2012 in The Eyes Don't Have It, Lie Detection and Neuro-Linguistic Programming by Wiseman and Watt, which found no correlation between eye contact and deceit, but instead a considerable correlation between hand gestures and deceit. So, while the lack of eye contact doesn't actually say anything about others, it may as well be true if people make those assumptions about you. On the other hand, there is a truly significant number of positive assumptions that we make about people who make eye contact and that can surely improve people's perception of you. Generally, people who make eye contact are seen as more dominant and powerful, warmer and more personable, more attractive and likable, more qualified, skilled, competent, and valuable, more trustworthy, honest, and sincere, and more confident and emotionally stable. In other words, just about all the things that are associated with social success. Why do we care so much about eye contact or the lack thereof? Is it just because we've been told from childhood to look at people in the eye and give them a firm handshake? Of course, it turns out that what may have started as old-fashioned advice from an older generation truly has many scientific confirmations. In 1978, in Effects of Eye Contact and Social Status on the Perception of a Job Applicant in an Employment Interviewing Situation, Tesler and Sushelsky found that we tend to make positive or negative assumptions based on how much someone meets our eye gaze. The more, the better. In 2001, in Accurate Intelligence Assessments in Social Interactions, Mediators, and Gender Effects, Murphy and Hall found that we generally consider those who return eye contact to be more intelligent, conscientious, and sincere. In 2016, in Direct Speaker Gaze Promotes Trust in Truth Ambiguous Statements, Kreisha and Kressler found that more eye contact promotes feelings of trust and genuineness. Oddly enough, you probably knew the outcomes of these studies already. Whether they represent the truth or are just assumptions, we have to make sure that we don't fall on the wrong side of those studies. As we are increasingly more caught up in a battle for our attention between our phones and our real-life conversation partners, the ability to make eye contact has become an especially powerful tool. When you can utilize eye contact smartly to show somebody that they have your undivided attention, you can effectively win them over and enhance their perception of you. There was never a need to convince you about the role of eye contact and trust, but there is one rather large caveat with eye contact. How should we use it? We can't simply stare into someone's eyes and try to read their souls. That is extremely uncomfortable and unsettling. In fact, eye contact has been shown to consume a significant amount of our brain power and focus when we utilize it. A 2016 Japanese study by Kajimura and Nomura entitled When We Cannot Speak, Eye Contact Disrupts Resources Available to Cognitive Control Processes During Verb Generation found that eye contact consumes a significant portion of our general cognitive resources, and it is difficult to perform other actions, even talking, while making focused eye contact. If this is true for us, it's true for the person you're speaking to. Sustained eye contact is uncomfortable and causes a special kind of internal tension. This is probably why we feel the need to break eye contact when we want to remember something or explain something more complex. Give people a break. In fact, in 2006, in a paper titled Helping Children Think, Gaze, Aversion, and Teaching by Phelps and Doherty-Sneddon, researchers found that kids told to look away while thinking and solving problems showed a 20% increase in performance. So, how can we improve our eye contact to create feelings of trust? It has to start from the scientific evidence that people feel uncomfortable with a lot of sustained eye contact, but they also feel that you're a shady character if you don't provide enough. Where is the thin line where you're making your best impression and being most likable? In 2016, Benetti and Hansen investigated the question of the average preferred length of eye contact. In Pupil Dilation as an Index of Preferred Mutual Gaze Duration, they found that the average preference was only 3 seconds before breaking contact and re-engaging later. Most people preferred something between 2 to 5 seconds, and no one preferred anything under 1 second or over 9 seconds. The thin line of eye contact appears to be that as long as you hold it for 3 seconds at a time, more often than not, then you'll be seen as trustworthy. More eye contact is not better, not even close to it. In 1975, in Eye Contact, Distance, and Affiliation, Argyle and Dean observed that people tend to maintain eye contact roughly to 40 to 60% of the time when conversing, and we should seek to maintain eye contact for 80% of the time. This leads us to my personal guidelines: make eye contact 50% when talking and 75% when listening. When you speak, you want others to be comfortable having their attention on you, but you also want to make sure that you don't appear to be hiding something or feeling uncomfortable yourself. And as you listen, you want whoever is speaking to see that you are engaged, but you don't want to look at them so much that they might feel creeped out. As long as you're in the general ballpark of 50% and 75% for speaking and listening respectively, you'll be making the most out of the surprisingly powerful tool of eye contact. Hello, listeners. This is Russell with Newton Media Group, and I want to thank you for the time you've spent listening to the Social Skills Coaching Podcast. It's been a pleasure presenting Patrick King's material, and I hope you found it useful. I want to let you know that we're producing another podcast for you to check out, The Art and Science of Self-Growth, written by Peter Hollins and produced by Newton Media Group. We'll have some bonus material in the next few episodes from that new podcast, and hope you'll find it informative and helpful. Check out the show notes for the anchor.fm link, or search your podcast provider for The Art and Science of Self-Growth by Peter Hollins. Before we get to that bonus audio, let me ask you a question. How often do you experience low energy or fatigue, erectile dysfunction, low sex drive, anxiety, brain fog, or even just have a hard time making decisions? These are all symptoms of a hormonal imbalance. And here's a stat for you. 1 in 4 men over 30 have hormonal imbalances and are low in testosterone. This condition is often misdiagnosed. I'd like to introduce you to our sponsor, Let's Get Checked, a company with a mission to make professional health testing easily accessible. They're fast, affordable, and confidential at-home male hormone test kits help you take a measured approach to your health and measure your hormone levels from the comfort of your home. Even better, Let's Get Checked customers can get 20% off by using this URL, trylgc.com/NMG. That's N as in Newton, M as in media, G as in group. It's really easy. Here's how it works. Go to trylgc.com/NMG. Choose your test online and it'll be delivered to you in discreet packaging with next day delivery. Activate your test online and collect your sample one morning. Return the sample using the prepaid shipping label provided. Once your sample arrives in the lab, results will be available from your online account within 2 to 5 days. You'll get results on 5 hormonal levels: testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, prolactin, estrogen, and your free androgen index, all without ever having to go to a doctor's office or a laboratory. I've recently experienced my own kind of brain fog and low energy. I was very interested in my hormone levels, and I can't think of a better way than was offered with Let's Get Checked. Everything needed was in the kit with step-by-step instructions. It only took 10 or 15 minutes for the whole process. This testing isn't just for men who think they're in a funk. All men should be testing their hormone levels on a regular basis. Let's Get Checked Labs are CLIA approved, and all data is completely anonymized. Get 20% off at trylgc.com/NMG. That's trylgc.com/NMG. N as in Newton, M as in media, G as in group. Now, back to the episode and that bonus material from the new podcast, The Art and Science of Self-Growth by Peter Hollins. Default Mode Network. As you might suspect and have experienced firsthand, the brain has multiple types of functioning modes. When you're sleeping, for instance, the brain has a very specific focus and set of duties. When you're trying to solve a difficult math problem, you activate what's called the executive attention network. This mental mode helps your brain hyperfocus and accomplish a specific goal that requires concentration and ignoring potential distractions. As you might also predict and hope, there's another type of mental mode that assists in creativity, abstract thinking, and the generation of ideas. It's not just one that you can push yourself into. Rather, it's the opposite. You must relax yourself into it. If a solution is outside of your brain's familiar experience, which is shaped by your beliefs, culture, and biases, your conscious mind will most likely never find it. The conscious mind deals too much in fact and the present, which stands in stark contrast to abstract thought and conceptual thinking. An analytical search for a solution can comb through the entire content of your mind's known, but not outside of it. Novel answers reside outside of your mind's known box, and the subconscious is the first place to look. When you allow your brain to integrate new information with existing knowledge on a subconscious level, it can establish new connections and see patterns not obvious to your conscious mind. Creative solutions and ideas are more likely to bubble up from a brain that applies unconscious thought to a problem rather than going at it in a deliberate approach with your frontal lobe. When your thinking brain is inundated with information and analysis, it doesn't have the opportunity to connect concepts or make creative leaps. Science shows that your brain's resting state, called the Default Mode Network, DMN, which is activated when you stop thinking about something specific and just veg out, is the best place to park a problem. In the DMN, your brain does some of its best, wisest, and most creative work. Research from Rachel and Snyder in 2007 demonstrates a predictable pattern of neurological activity that's your brain's go-to state when it's at rest, not focused on anything in particular or actively engaging with its environment. It's associated with experimental thinking, mind wandering, emotions, past encounters, and intuition. The imagination network is used in situations like brainstorming, painting, daydreaming, or devising a new recipe. Yes, this is where you might consider most creative thinking to occur, while execution and analysis occurs in the other mental networks. This mental state is also where ruminating and worrying takes place. Hey, no one said that it wasn't going to have its downsides. The harder and more cognitively demanding a particular task is, the less the DMN is activated. We'll discuss later on how to use this DMN to your advantage. Creatives, crazy or genius? When some of us think of legendarily creative people, we occasionally make the very dubious observation that many of them were, to some degree, crazy. The meaning of creativity
infers the ability to invent something out of nothing, to call into existence something that wasn't there just a second ago. That involves going outside the info processing boundaries of the brain and just making things up, which some people might consider crazy. To be sure, there have been some artists and creators who suffered from a variety of emotional disorders. Charles Dickens, Ernest Hemingway, Virginia Woolf, Tennessee Williams, and Leo Tolstoy all dealt with clinical depression at some point, according to certain studies, which were, it should be noted, highly contested by some. Researchers also determined that many, but not all, creatives endured difficult life experiences like losing their parents, social rejection, or physical handicaps. But no evidence has conclusively proven that mental illness is a contributor to a creative person's productivity. A study of over 1 million Swedish citizens conducted over a span of 4 decades and completed in 2012 found that artists were not likelier to have psychiatric ailments. They were, however, found to have an unusually high number of relatives who suffered conditions like autism, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or anorexia nervosa. Artists themselves typically had more highly developed schizotypal traits. Despite the name, having these traits isn't quite the same as having a schizophrenic disorder. In fact, almost everybody on Earth has these characteristics. Schizotypal traits are mainly positive. Generally speaking, they involve what motivational speakers would call thinking outside the box, unique perspectives and experiences, nonconformance, maybe even a fanciful belief in magic. There are some unseemly schizotypal traits as well, cognitive disarray and difficulty feeling pleasure, but by and large, the schizotype reflects the positive aspects over the negative. A 2008 study by British scientists Mark Beatty and Adrian Furman found that positive schizotypes were associated with character traits like confidence, insight, resourcefulness, diverse interests, and even sexiness. They were also oriented toward doing at least one creative thing every day. Then, of course, there's the precuneus. The precuneus is a part of the superior parietal lobule, located between the left and right hemispheres of the brain. There's still some mystery about how it actually functions in relation to other parts of the brain, but it's known to have several very complex jobs: memory retrieval and processing, environmental analysis, cue processing, organizing mental images, and pain reaction. How the precuneus relates to creative people is that they can't turn the darn thing off. Neuroscientist Hikaru Takeuchi found in 2011 that creative types could not suppress their precuneus. They were unable to filter out inessential brain activity. While this might sound like Takeuchi said creatives were cluttered with meaningless thoughts, what he actually meant was that they had more access to creative stimuli and could put ideas from different networks together. And in 2013, Austrian researcher Andreas Finck found that there was a direct link between the inability to suppress the precuneus and higher generation of original ideas. What this all means is that the key to creative thinking is to let as much information into one's brain as possible in order to make connections and associations between different elements. Even if that cognitive process results in strange, outlandish, weird, or, say it together, crazy associations, those connections often produce the most creative ideas. This can be great for generating hundreds of ideas at once, if properly harnessed, or result in mental chatter you can't escape that completely drowns out coherent thoughts. It can be a double-edged sword. I don't want to speculate on whether Da Vinci was crazy, but we do know that he came up with blueprints for the airplane, the parachute, the bicycle, the guided missile, and even the snorkel multiple centuries before they were physically invented. He could only generate those ideas by letting his precuneus run wild and thinking as creatively as anybody ever could. If that's crazy, then I'll have more crazy. Just know that the side effects for such heights may be more than you bargained for.